/VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo is here with a slippery words and their stories. Then, Andrew Smith and Katie bring us this week's Higher Education Report. Finally, Kelly Jean Kelly closes the program with our series on America's presidents. This week, it's James K. Polk. But first, here's Ashley Thompson.
A new study has found that about 25% of jobs are going to change in the next 5 years. The finding comes from a survey of employers published Monday by the World Economic Forum, WEF. About 69 million jobs will be created and 83 million will be removed by 2027, it said. That will result in a total decrease of 2% of current employment. The survey is based on data from about 800 companies employing more than 11 million workers. It used data from 673 million jobs. Technology and digitalization can lead to both the creation of jobs and the destruction of jobs. A summary of the report said, companies are looking to increase their use of new technologies like artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and big data, the study found. More than 75% of companies say they will be using those technologies in the next 5 years. About 86% of companies surveyed said they want to use more digital platforms and mobile apps. Machines already do a large amount of work. The companies surveyed estimated that 34% of tasks are done by machines, with 66% of tasks completed by humans. AI is expected to be used by 75% of surveyed companies in the coming years. As a result, the fastest-growing jobs are related to technology. The fastest-declining jobs will be those that can be automated, like secretaries and bank tellers. The demand for AI machine learning specialists and cybersecurity experts is expected to grow greatly, the report said. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Oil and water are two very different substances. Oil is thick, water is thin. If you pour oil into water, they do not mix, and the oil floats to the top. This difficult relationship can play a part in some laboratory experiments. It can play a big part in kitchens as we cook food. It can also be used to describe some of our personal relationships. If we say two people are like oil and water, it means they do not get along. They are not compatible. Things like objects, elements, and people that do not or cannot mix together easily can be compared to oil and water. Here is an example from experience. My friend often asked me to watch her cat, Bluey, when she would travel out of town. Usually, cats love me, but not Bluey. He would make terrible cat noises as soon as I walked into the apartment. Every time I tried to pet him, he would bite or scratch me. So I didn't like him either. We were like oil and water. I took care of him, but for the most part, we ignored each other. This expression describes how oil and water naturally separate. They are incompatible. So are people who have nothing in common and do not get along. We sometimes say oil and water do not mix, to express an opinion that two things do not go together. Here is another oil expression. If you pour oil on troubled water, you calm a tense situation. You might not hear this expression too much in America, as it is mainly a British usage. Now let's hear the expression used between two friends.
I'm worried about my birthday party.
Why? It's not until next weekend.
It doesn't matter. My two best friends will never find a way to get along. Ben likes to plan everything and is a bit of a control freak. Kara is super easygoing and likes to play things by ear.
Those two sound like oil and water.
They are. And they want to throw the party together. What a truly bad idea.
I have a good idea. I'll come to the party early. If things between them get heated, I'll get between them and calm things down.
You'll be the oil on my troubled waters.
Sure. Whatever you say. I just want to have fun at your party.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you, Anna. I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Broadcast. We are joined now by Anna Mateo. Anna, welcome to the show. Remind our listeners what you discussed this week.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan. This week, on Words and Their Stories, I talk about things that do not mix. Oil and water.
Yeah, if you put oil into water, they do not work well together. The oil floats to the top.
That's right. So if two things or two people are like oil and water, they do not get along. They are incompatible.
Anna, so it's a good thing for our listeners that we do get along. I enjoy our weekly chats, but tell me, is this expression only used for people who do not get along?
We do get along. And to answer your question, we can use this expression to describe other things that don't get along. For example, for some people, getting a good night's sleep and reading the news before bedtime are like oil and water. Not compatible.
I can see that. I would not want to read bad news before I hope to have sweet dreams. Thanks for getting into this sometimes slippery expression with us.
You're welcome, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Nearly 3 hours after midnight, Tajay Robinson and Ayanna Trotman of Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, finally heard the judge's decision. They had defeated the University of Michigan in the finals on April 4th. After 12 debates over 4 straight days, the Wake Forest team won the 2023 National Debate Tournament, or NDT. Their coach, Justin Green, described the moment as hugging, yelling, crying, and laughing. Over 500 colleges and universities in the United States have competitive debate programs. The program gives students a chance to work together to argue for or against an issue or statement.
Students and their coaches point to several benefits of the activity. They say debate helps develop research skills, critical thinking skills, time management, and public speaking. John Turner is director of debate at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He said debaters research issues in detail and across many different areas of knowledge.
We are drawing from academic materials from so many different subfields, many of which are never in conversation with each other. We are bringing this full variety of perspectives to bear on a common point.
Turner added that debaters can bring knowledge that other students might not have to their classes, especially in the social sciences. And undergraduate debaters often do as much research in a year as graduate students in master's and doctoral programs. Kelly Phil is a member of the Michigan team that reached the NDT finals. She said research for her classes seems incredibly easy compared to the research for debate. Phil studies political science and history. Like Turner, she said debate research is useful for classes.
Debate gives you this big background reservoir of knowledge that you can draw on at any point when you're writing a paper.
Anna Bittner is another debater from Wake Forest. She thinks she is more well-read than other students, and that debate has improved her ability to quickly process large amounts of information. For example, Bittner said she quickly looked through a 550-page book in about 1 hour to find information to support her debate arguments. Michaela Malson is director of debate at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. She said debate helps students think about both sides of an issue and learn respect for others.
Not many activities or areas that you encounter really challenge you to think differently and to take on different perspectives. The switch side nature of policy debate is really significant.
Like student athletes, top debaters travel to competitions on weekends. And they can spend up to 30 or 40 hours a week preparing for important tournaments. Ari Davidson of Wake Forest said a debater might miss up to 10 classes each semester. This makes it very difficult for some students to debate,
especially if they have science classes that require time in laboratories. Phil of Michigan said the extra time she spends on debate feels like just another part of academic life. She also finds that debating makes her more willing to speak in class. She says that when she has a clear idea of what she wants to say, it's really not that difficult to speak in public. Both Melson and Turner said the best debaters can combine large amounts of information and explore many different arguments. Above all, Davidson and Turner said the activity acts as a laboratory for testing ideas and looking for solutions to big problems.
Kamel Belmihoud came from Algeria to study at Clarion University in Pennsylvania. English is not his first language. In fact, it was his fourth, but that did not stop him from joining the debate team. For the first year and a half, Belmihoud lost every debate. But his coaches kept supporting him, and he enjoyed the travel and being a member of the debate community. Over time, Belmihoud increased his language skill and confidence. In his last semester, he won several debates. Now, Belmihoud teaches writing at Baruch College of the City University of New York. He includes in-class debates as part of his teaching. Belmihoud says international students should not let fear stop them from trying debate or other activities. Instead, they should center on the progress they're making and being part of a team. I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Knox Polk moved into the White House as the 11th President of the United States in 1845. Few had predicted that Polk would become president. Even he was surprised. Polk had come to his party's presidential nominating convention nearly a year earlier with low expectations. But the top politicians, including former President Martin Van Buren, failed to win a majority of votes. Convention delegates tried again and again to agree on a candidate. Eventually, Polk was nominated. A small number of delegates supported him. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. He became the first dark horse candidate in U.S. history to be nominated by a major party. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win, but he did. Polk was born in the southeastern state of North Carolina. When he was a child, his family moved west to Tennessee. At the time, Tennessee had few white settlers. Some considered it the wilderness. Polk's family did well there. His father became wealthy, buying land and enslaved people. His mother, Jane, who followed strict Christian religious teachings, gave her 10 children a good education. James was the oldest. He went to college, then studied law. When he was 25, he married an intelligent and wealthy young woman named Sarah Childress. The two never had children, but they worked together to launch Polk's political career. In time, Polk was elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives, then the National House of Representatives. There, he developed a close relationship with President Andrew Jackson. Since Jackson was called Old Hickory, Polk became known as Young Hickory. When Polk left Congress and returned to Tennessee to become governor, he supported Jackson's banking reforms. But soon the U.S. economy collapsed. Tennessee voters failed to reelect Polk as governor, not once, but twice. So Polk returned to his plantations and waited for a chance to re-enter national politics. In 1844, Polk traveled to the city of Baltimore to attend the Democratic Party's national convention. He thought he could perhaps win the nomination for vice president. Instead, he became the Democrats' candidate for president. Several months later, he narrowly defeated the opposing party's candidate in the national election. Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about Polk's presidency. Mary says one reason Polk won the election was the issue of Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading candidates did not. Mary says the other candidates were right. The United States eventually went to war with Mexico. But Polk spoke for the American people. In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and take control of the continent. As a result, many voters supported Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Several previous presidents had served 2 terms. Polk told voters presidents might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But Robert Mary says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. It was a political bet. Polk thought if he said he would serve as president for only one term, other party leaders might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years, instead of waiting 8. He was probably right. If Polk had not made the campaign promise, Mary says, Young Hickory would not have won. During the first days of his administration, James K. Polk famously listed the 4 things he planned to do as president. He wanted to reduce taxes on imports. He wished to establish an independent treasury. He hoped to settle the dispute with Britain over the Oregon border. And he wanted to get California for the United States. Less than 4 years later, Polk had realized each item on his list. He is remembered for greatly expanding the size of the United States. He successfully negotiated with Britain for U.S. control over territory in the West up to the 49th parallel. The agreement gave the U.S. the current states of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. Below those states lay California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said, "The port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world." He said, "Someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean." There was only one problem from the point of view of the U.S. government. California was part of Mexico. At first, U.S. officials attempted to buy California from Mexico, but Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. Shortly after the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the U.S. altogether. The following year, Mexican troops crossed the Rio Grande and clashed with American soldiers. In answer, President Polk asked Congress to declare war. He did not think the conflict would last long. He believed the U.S. declaration would quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. Polk was wrong. Historian Robert Mary says, "The war with Mexico lasted longer, was more expensive, and cost more lives than Polk expected." But in the 1848 treaty that ended the war, Polk got the land he had wanted. Mexico recognized the independence of Texas and did not stop it from joining the United States. And it sold the areas that are now all or part of the states of Arizona, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, Wyoming, Colorado, and, yes, California. President Polk kept his promise to serve only one term. After 4 years, he retired from the presidency, traveled for a few weeks, and then returned to Tennessee to settle in a new home. But Polk did not have much time there. He had been sick often throughout his life, but he became seriously ill during his travels. Only 3 months after he left the White House, Polk died. He left behind a much larger country, but a divided one. The issue was again slavery. Southerners argued that they had the right to take enslaved people into California and other former Mexican lands. Northerners opposed any further spread of slavery. The question was this: did Congress have the power to control or even ban slavery in the new territories? I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. www.theheatsmith.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.